terrorize animals.
Good guy.
Yeah.
Okay, good morning, everybody. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to begin or waiting for the signal. Okay. Where were you guys for Shabbos? Where? Very nice. Okay, well, I hope everyone is doing well and enjoying the Israeli summer. It's kind of almost the first day of real summer we've had. God has been extraordinarily generous with the relatively cool weather, but now we're coming back to normal. I taught law for many, many years, and among a number of my students were doctors. And when you would ask the question, well, why would a doctor that has a successful medical practice decide at the age of 50 or 55 to go to law school, the answer usually was that they were involved in some type of malpractice lawsuit against them, and they want to understand the system so they will not be victimized by it. Malpractice liability is indeed a very, very major issue. Again, I speak mainly from the United States, but really worldwide, in which juries will often give astronomical amounts of money for people that are suffering as a result of alleged malpractice. But one has to remember, too, that on one hand, there are two different competing values here. On one hand, people that are seriously hurt as a result of something wrong that a physician did ought to be compensated. They're victims. They have been victimized. There are people who are paralyzed for life. There are people, obviously, who die, and then families get wrongful death. There is disfiguring injury. So certainly, any compassionate, civilized system will want to protect people that have suffered so tremendously. Of course, it's not really protecting them. They have the suffering. So whatever money you give them is not really compensating, but you do what you can. On the other hand, one has to also take into account that large malpractice judgments do have an effect on the practice of medicine in a lot of ways. Number one, it greatly increases. Most malpractice judgments are not paid from the doctor's own assets. They're paid from malpractice insurance, right? But the insurance depends on the premiums. And because of malpractice liability being so great, insurance premiums can sometimes be astronomical, depending, of course, on the specialty. Certain specialties are higher risk. The malpractice premiums are very high. I believe, last time I checked, the two highest risk specialties were anesthesiology, where a little bit can create brain damage, and orthopedic surgery, interestingly enough, can be very serious. Obstetrics is also relatively high risk because of problems in delivery. Something like dermatology might be less so. So one of the decisions you might be making, and I hope that will not drive your decision, but practically speaking, sometimes people make specialty decisions based on malpractice premiums and potential liability. But what this also means is, as the cost of malpractice insurance goes up, the cost of health care goes up. It goes up because it's either passed to the consumer or more likely just passed to the system as a whole. It also creates the phenomenon that is called defensive medicine, where doctors are testing because they want to be sure that there won't be a malpractice liability. And although it might be good to test, but there's a certain amount of over-testing, which in turn adds yet another layer of cost to the system. So it's the malpractice cost, it's the defensive medicine cost, and the like. And finally, maybe the biggest cost of all is it actually is driving people out of the field. Now, in big cities, there'll be enough people in virtually every specialty that you'll be covered. But if you go to rural areas in the United States, it is sometimes difficult to literally find a single anesthesiologist that will practice, or sometimes even obstetrics might be difficult, right? So it is not an exaggeration. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it is a documented fact that the threat of malpractice liability has driven people out of the medical profession, or at least has driven them out of underserved areas to places where to move to a bigger city or whatever it is. So malpractice liability, although indeed it can be justified as a matter of fairness, compassion, and justice, does have an impact on the entire system, which can sometimes be detrimental. I should also say that many malpractice issues are decided by juries. Again, I don't know how familiar you are with the legal system, but I'm sure if you've watched enough television, you know that generally speaking, in the United States, in England, Israel as well, so a plaintiff can choose to have many cases decided just by a judge or to go to a jury. Most malpractice victims or plaintiffs elect to go to juries for a very simple reason. A judge simply follows the law, and a judge is not supposed to be swayed by emotion and suffering. A judge is supposed to be objective. Are all judges objective? Certainly not, but that is the theory of the system. A jury is also supposed to be guided by the law. That's why a judge, before the jury goes and deliberates, the judge reads the jury a long, boring discussion of what the law is and tells the jury, you must follow the law. But as we say in Hebrew, lamaaseh, practically, once juries are in the room, they can do almost anything they want. And juries, because they're regular people like you and me, are often swayed by compassion, and they'll figure, hey, here you have somebody who's suffering, the hospital or the insurance company has plenty of money, they ought to pay. When in fact, maybe there was no carelessness, maybe there was no malpractice, maybe there was no negligence. But nevertheless, as a matter of compassion, the judgments often get skewed. That, number one, has a financial impact on everybody else's insurance premiums. And number two, it casts aspersions on physicians who are not guilty of anything. And as I say, in extreme cases, it even drives people away from the practice of medicine, resulting in people in need being underserved. Right? So this is what is a very brief summary of what is called the malpractice crisis. And that is why Republicans are always calling for what they call tort reform. That's really what they mean. When Republicans say we need to have tort reform, they basically mean that they want to reform the medical malpractice system in various ways, and I'll discuss what those ways are. And this is really almost a Republican-Democratic issue in the United States. Democrats love the litigation system. That is why the Association of Trial Lawyers are all Democrats. And the people who advocate for curbs in the system tend to be conservative Republicans. So it is a liberal conservative issue. So now the question obviously becomes, if one is interested in Judaism, one is interested in a Torah perspective, so how does the Torah deal with physician liability for things that go wrong? And unfortunately, things do go wrong. One of the things that you're going to learn as a doctor is no matter how skillful you are, no matter how talented you are, you're going to have patients that will die on you. You're going to have cases where you realize that if you would have done something else, perhaps a certain result wouldn't happen. The old saying, hindsight is 20/20, is true in all areas of life, and it's absolutely going to be true in medicine. And the issue basically becomes, what does halacha say about this? Well, procedurally, let me just point out an obvious point. Halacha does not have anything called a jury, so procedurally, if this would be in a halachic system, it would be decided by judges who are learned rabbis. And it would not be a single judge, but typically it would be what we call a Beit Din, which is a rabbinical court, and the number of judges would commonly be three. But that's a procedural issue. I'm not going to focus so much on procedure as the actual basis of the law. So first, in order to put malpractice in perspective, let's go back in a more general level and ask ourselves, what is the Jewish view of what you might call tort law? If I hurt you, whether I take a baseball bat and knock you over the head, or whether I go through a stop sign and I run somebody over, in other words, forget about physicians. What are the general liabilities of one person towards another person if they have caused damage or injury? So the halacha is very clear. There is a principle that if I cause you injury, it makes no difference if it was an accident, or it was negligent, or it was intentional. Right? You have three levels of people causing injuries. Intentional, I deliberately hit you over the head with a baseball. Right? That's kind of the bad guy. There is what is called negligence. I didn't intend to hurt you, but I went through a red light and I ran you over. You'll call that negligent or careless. And the third is accident. Thank you. I'm driving my car and the brakes fail, and I didn't know there was anything wrong with the brakes, and I run somebody over. Right? You understand these are three different ways. Again, we're not getting to physicians yet. I'll move into that. These are three different ways you can hurt somebody: intentional, negligent, purely accidental. Generally speaking, Jewish law is a very strict system. Jewish law actually says, I am unconditionally liable for damages that I cause another person, even if it was an accident, which could have been avoided. This is very important, and this is expressed in a three-word principle called Adam. Adam means a person. Mu'ad li'olam. A person is perpetually in a state of being warned, meaning you are warned not to cause peril or danger to other people. So to use a little bit of legal terminology, and again, I apologize since nobody here is a lawyer, but this is kind of my second language, this is what is called a strict liability system. It is not a liability based on fault. It is a strict liability system in which you are responsible for what you cause, even if it was an unavoidable accident, if you are the causal agent. So that is called strict liability. Now, let me point out that the American system with many, many exceptions, is fundamentally what is called a fault liability system. Meaning, going through the example of the car, if I go through a red light because the brakes failed on me, I'm not going to be liable for that because there was no negligence or carelessness. Meaning, under American law, with many exceptions, so please do not assume this is the way it actually works, but conceptually, under American law, I am liable for damages that I intentionally cause, or that's called assault and battery, basically, if I hit somebody over the head with a baseball bat, or I am liable for damages in which there was an element of carelessness, and that's called negligence, that's the legal term. But I am not strictly liable for unavoidable accident. So that is called a fault-based system. So these are the two types of liability systems that exist in legal cultures. There is what is called a strict liability system, and there is what is called a fault liability system. U.S. law is a fault liability system. Halacha is largely a strict liability system. Now, let me just qualify, I don't want to give you a whole class on American law here, but let me just qualify that in many, many areas of the law, American law itself has moved away from fault into strict liability. For example, in defective products. If the Ford Motor Company makes a defective car, even if it was as good as they could have done, meaning to say it was no fault in their design, but if the design was defective somehow, courts have now held them responsible. So there are a lot of pockets of law in which we move from fault to strict, but the underlying foundational principle of American law is liability based on fault. Jewish law is liability based on causation. If I caused you harm, I am responsible, even if there was no fault on my part. I'm sorry, you wanted to say something?
How do you define liability?
Okay, that's an excellent question. Liability right now, I'm going to define it much more specifically, simply means you got to pay for the harm. Now, the question is, what do you pay for?
Okay.
I'm going to get to that. Excellent, excellent question. Okay. So now I want to focus again on Jewish law, halacha, and again, I'm not talking about doctors yet, because I want you to understand the general system. Even though Jewish law says, let's take the example of an automobile accident. I can give you all three scenarios of liability with a car. One is, I intentionally ran you over. The other is, I was texting and I went through a red light and I ran you over. And the third is, there was sudden brake failure, of which I had no reason to be aware. Right, so case number one is intention. Case number two is carelessness or negligence, going through a red light. Case number three is unavoidable accident. Now, there is a common denominator in all three cases, I got to pay you. But, that's called liability, but what I have to pay you actually differs from case to case. If I injure you intentionally, that's the worst thing, that's the bad guy. I deliberately run you over, I hit you on the head with a baseball bat. Then, the halacha says, I must compensate you for five different things. And let me list what those five things are. Assuming there was loss of limb or permanent disability, I must pay you for loss of limb or permanent disability. Now, how do you measure permanent disability, halachically? In other words, a person loses an arm, or a person is paralyzed. What monetary value do we put on that? Well, in reality, there is no monetary value. Certain things are not quantifiable, but halacha attempts to quantify it, and it's very fascinating what it does. Halacha works with the concept of a hypothetical slave market. Meaning, how much would you as a healthy person command in the slave market? Now that depends on your health, your strength, your age, your skills, etc. And we do a before and after comparison. How much were you worth before the accident? How much are you worth after the accident? That represents, in an economic quantifiable term, your loss. So, to take an example, if before the accident, your slave market hypothetical value, based on life expectancy and skills and strength, and of course, that may decline with the passage of time, is $1 million. And now, after you lose the arm, right, somebody would only pay $100,000, or in the case of a paraplegic, they would pay nothing at all. So the loss of limb is the difference between the hypothetical economic value you had before the injury versus the hypothetical economic value you had after the injury. Now, in the ancient world, there was an active slave market. So as a result, we could theoretically, through expert testimony, quantify what the economic diminution was. Today, it's a little more difficult for a baysman to do. Unfortunately, there still are slave markets in the world, in the Sudan and the like, so we would have to get some guy from the Sudan to kind of tell us, what does this healthy specimen go for, etc. But again, it may sound outrageous to talk about slave markets, but you understand that a slave market was actually a commodification or a quantification of human value. Now, of course, human life is infinite and cannot be quantified. But we got to do the best we can. For me to say to a victim, well, sorry, we can't give you anything because your life is of infinite value, I mean, makes no sense. You're using infinity to then make an argument, we're not going to give you anything. So as a result, slave market is not a bad way to assess the economic value in terms of a diminution of value. Now, that's only item one. That's item one. Item two is lost wages. Now, this does not mean permanent lost wages, because permanent diminution in earning was actually folded into the slave market equation. But even if you have permanent disability, and let's say you could go from making 500 a week to making 100 a week, but there may be a period of short-term hospitalization where you can't even do your reduced functioning. So the lost earnings is a compensation for the inability to even earn reduced income for the period of immobilization. So that might be 6 months, it might be a year, it might be 2 years, and the like. Okay, so that's the second item. Third item is medical expenses, including hospitalization, medicine, whatever therapies are needed, occupational therapy, physical therapy. Interesting halachic question about how does insurance play into this. Let's say a patient has insurance that covers his medical expenses. Is he still entitled, he or she still entitled, to recover those medical expenses from the perpetrator or their insurance company? The short answer is yes. Halacha does not require that you apply insurance towards somebody's obligation to pay you, and you can get paid twice. In modern law, American law, that would not work necessarily, but in halacha, you get the benefit. You get the benefit of your insurance. It doesn't go to the benefit of the bad guy. So I mentioned three items: permanent diminution of value based on hypothetical slave market. In Hebrew, that is called nezek, which means damage. The second is short-term loss of income due to hospitalization or immobilization. That is called shevet. Shevet are lost wages. The third is ripui. Ripui are medical expenses, and that would include psychological therapy as well if the trauma necessitated that type of assistance. And as I say, even if you have insurance, that does not diminish your recovery rights. The fourth is compensation for pain. In malpractice judgments, by the way, that is often the biggest item. Pain and suffering. Pain and suffering. Now, this is where juries, by the way, can often go crazy, because lost wages and medical expenses are quantifiable, but pain is almost not quantifiable. That's when a jury might get billions of dollars or whatever it is. But halacha faces the same problem. I am a victim. I am entitled to be compensated for pain. Okay, well, how much do I get for pain? So here, the Mishnah gives you a formula. And I'm going to admit that I have difficulty with how to apply this formula. I don't even know. So I'm going to admit my partial ignorance here. The formula says, we try to figure out how much money would a person take in order, I'm sorry, how much money would a person be willing to give to avoid this pain? You were given a choice, pain or money. Would you give $1 million, $2 million? Now you don't have it, but we ask, would you give $100 million, etc.? At whatever point you would say, well, I'm not going to give, you know, $1 trillion for it. In other words, it's based on how much you would be willing to give up is the value of the pain. What you're not willing to give up is more to you than the pain. Now, it seems to me that, I just don't know how you quantify that, because I think most people would rather be pain-free than filthy rich. I mean, if you'd have a choice of giving up your fortune and not suffering, now it depends. Sometimes accidents might be minor. If I have a minor, you know, not all pain is the devastating pain of, you know, somebody that, you know, lost a limb or is a paraplegic or whatever it is. Sometimes pain might be minor, and if it's minor, you can figure this out. How you figure it out in major pain is very, very difficult. But there is compensation for pain. Of course, this raises an interesting question. What is pain? Is pain only things that your nervous system feels? I mean, for example, is a paraplegic or quadriplegic? Now, in a literal sense, they're not suffering pain, they don't feel anything. But there is mental anguish. It's a very interesting question. Is pain a physicalist notion of neurological sensations that go to the brain? Or does pain have a psychological component of mental anguish, suffering, and despondency? Now, you'll notice that in the legal system, this is called an award for pain and suffering. And in point of fact, the choice of those words are deliberate. Pain is the physical pain, right? I stick a needle in your hand, there's pain. Suffering is the connotation of mental anguish, which may not have a physicalist component, right? You could be paralyzed, you could be not having any sensations at all. But there is suffering, being trapped. Where we run into a problem is that although the American legal system and the English use pain and suffering, halakha only uses one word, and that one word is tsar. Tsar means, well, it can mean pain, or it can mean suffering, but it's only one word. So the question that one has to think about is, does tsar include both components, or only one component, and which one? Again, debatable question. The rabbis debate and discuss. In Talmudic times, generally speaking, the reference was to physical pain. But we now understand that pain has different dimensions. So I've mentioned, again, just to keep track, I've mentioned four items. And I've mentioned permanent loss of function. I've mentioned short-term loss of income. I've mentioned medical expenses. I mentioned pain. Now, the fifth one, that's four, right? And the fifth one is a psychic pain, but it's not the mental anguish. It is humiliation, which may or may not exist. Now, humiliation, which in Hebrew is boshet is shame, that refers to the idea that many types of injuries create a certain humiliation. So, for example, a burn victim might be so disfigured that they are ashamed, they're embarrassed to be seen in the street. There is also, now shame could be even things that are relatively small. For example, if somebody slapped me in the face. Now that's not a permanent shame, that's going to be, no, I have been embarrassed, somebody spit at me. There's actually compensation for embarrassment, for humiliation. Now, that's not quite the same as mental anguish. Shame is a component of mental anguish. But, for example, the mental anguish of a paraplegic is not because they're embarrassed. It's because they're not able to function, right? So these are very subtle distinctions. So I would say that shame is clearly a component of mental anguish, but it doesn't address my question. My question about mental anguish that does not have physical pain or shame is still going to be a good question. That is not covered by this list. Okay, so these are five items of recovery. But what's interesting about these five items of recovery is they only apply to intentional behaviors. So if I intentionally run you over, I have to compensate you for all of these items. If I hit you with a baseball bat, I have to compensate you. If I spit at you, although there's maybe not a loss of income, but I have to compensate you for your embarrassment and shame. These are intentional behaviors. But if it was an accident, or even if it was negligent, the halacha says I only have to pay the actual out-of-pocket losses that you incur, such as your loss of earning power and your medical expenses. I don't compensate for emotional damages, such as pain and embarrassment. So, just to give you a trivial example, if I sneezed and some of my saliva got on your face, you cannot sue me for embarrassment, right? If I spit at you, you could, but not if it was just an accident. Okay, now, so what's interesting is that although, again, I haven't even gotten to malpractice yet, I'm going to get to it. Although it is true that halacha starts off as a strict liability system, it does have a sharp divide between fault liability and accident vis-a-vis what you pay for. So liability is not I think this answers your question. Liability is not a unitary concept. In certain types of accidents, it has certain implications. In certain types of accidents, it has a lesser or greater meaning, right? So that's a very important idea, that halacha is nuanced, that although it may say you're responsible no matter what happens, but the level and magnitude of your responsibility may differ from scenario to scenario. Okay, this is the general halachic system that you need to be aware of. Yeah?
I'm sorry, you said that negligence they pay for 1 to 4, just not 5?
No. A negligence only, both negligence and accident only pays 1, 2, and possibly 3.
So pain.
That's correct. There is no pain. That's right. Now, let me point out, too, though, that you get into very, very tricky issues, and that is, there is a point at which negligence can be so severe that we treat it as intention. Meaning, negligence, strictly speaking, is not intentional. I went through a red light, I didn't intend to run you over. Okay? But there may be some types of carelessness that is so gross, so great, that halacha will basically say we're going to treat that like intention. An example might be that you're firing off your gun in your backyard where there are kids playing, but you know you didn't intend to hit the kid. At some point, you know, you have to be so careless and irresponsible that we will treat it like an intention, and therefore you'll have to pay for pain and suffering and all the other things. An example might be drunk driving. Now again, even the example I gave you, going through a red light, you know, maybe we would differentiate. If you're going through a red light in an area that has school, you know, school children, like Jerusalem, like a million kids all over the place, that might cross the line, as opposed to going through a red light in an area that's not frequented that much. So it's a bit tricky. In other words, the system can be described fairly precisely in theory, but the actual applications are going to be tricky, because there are going to be times that negligence slides into intentionality, and then you'd have a different set of rules. Yeah.
Is that kind of what the difference would be if you're suing somebody for manslaughter versus murder?
Yes. It's very similar. Manslaughter is based on negligence, homicide, basically, and murder is based on intentional. And at some point, when you have what's called gross negligence in the legal system, it may move into murder. But of course, that's in the context of criminal prosecution. But the same thing is true in civil liability. In secular law, gross severe negligence might be treated as intentional, and halacha would provide the same same thing. And again, it's a complicated system. I'm going back and forth between law and halacha. They're both complicated systems. But we have a whole tractate of the Talmud dealing with accident law, so to speak. And this tracts it's around 110 folio pages, which means 220 pages. Very, very hard and dense material. This is tractate Baba Kama. Maybe you've heard of it. Baba Kama literally has the very undescriptive title called First Gate. It doesn't tell you what it's about, but basically Baba Kama is the Jewish law of accidents and torts. And it is very complicated because we have other ideas that come into the mix as well. It's not only the idea of negligence, intentionality, and accident. Right? Those are the three things I talked about with the different liability rules. There's also competing ideas of contributory negligence. Let's say the victim was equally careless. So at that point, that may reduce some of the liability. Right? So you have to factor in, did the victim do something that was irresponsible? That maybe the victim was crossing where he shouldn't have crossed, even though I should have stopped, but, you know, etc. So all of that gets factored in, so it gets into a very, very complicated morass. If I go to a baseball game and I get hit on the head with a baseball and I get hurt, now certainly that's not intentional, hopefully, but at least it's an accident. Do they have to pay me, or is it the concept that if I walk into a baseball game and I pay my money, I'm assuming certain risks? Okay, all of that is factored in. Okay, so now let's go into the application of these laws regarding physicians or nurses or healthcare providers. So in American law, again, I think it's helpful to compare. In American law, there really is nothing unique about malpractice liability. Obviously, it has specific applications, but in American law, we apply the same rule to physician liability that we apply to anybody else. Now, I already told you, American law is primarily not strict liability. American law is fault liability. And for unavoidable accidents, you're not liable at all, unlike halacha. Well, that is exactly the rule that we apply to medical malpractice, meaning, although obviously medical malpractice has developed into a whole specialty, you can find volumes and volumes of books, but in its inception, it is nothing more than a particularized application of the general false principles that underlay all of American tort liability. Now again, a lawyer would think I'm sounding crazy by saying there's nothing unique about medical malpractice. Of course there is, because of the technicalities involved. But conceptually, the word malpractice basically means a doctor is not liable for bad results. A doctor is not liable because things didn't turn out well. A doctor is not liable for errors that are not the result of carelessness or mistake. Meaning a doctor is only liable for intent, which Baruch Hashem is very rare, but sometimes it happens. What happened here? Talk about stupid boyfriends. There was a boyfriend who broke up with his girlfriend, but she happened to be a dentist. So he went to her. After he broke up, he asked her to do some dental work on him, do a filling or something, or an implant. So she, under anesthesia, she pulled out all of his teeth. Okay. I mean, again, that kind of stupid boyfriend, you know. Anyway, so that is the rare example of a doctor intentionally, you know, doing something to a patient, and I'm sure she accident, right? Okay. But putting aside intent, a physician is only liable for what is negligence. Negligence means a deviation from the standard of care that professionals are expected to live by. Now, how do you establish negligence? Generally, in fact, this is one of the difficulties historically that plaintiffs have had. You have to have doctors testify as to what is the customary thing that is done, and if there was a deviation. Right? Doctors don't like to testify against doctors because then they may get in trouble. But whatever it is, there's a whole genre of doctors. In fact, I have a friend who actually makes his living not by practicing medicine anymore, but by being an expert witness in malpractice trials. Now, he tends to do it for the defense, but whatever. There are doctors who do it for plaintiffs, right? It's a whole specialty. and you can actually make a living being an expert witness at these trials. And doctors are known, I'm not defending the morality of it, because it seems to me, how can you always, you know, I understand a doctor that sometimes it's for the plaintiff and sometimes it's for the defendant, because sometimes one is right, sometimes the other is right. But how can you consistently always be for the same side? You know, I think there's a bit of a problem there. But okay, but putting that aside, generally speaking, malpractice requires the proof of a deviation of an acceptable standard of care. And really, the point I want to bring home is that this is nothing different than negligence, showing that somebody was careless, they didn't do the right thing. Now, this is the secular standard of malpractice. By the way, it's a very interesting question. It used to be, in the olden days, in the 1960s and earlier than the 1960s, every locality was deemed to have a different standard, meaning to say, the standard of care in New York City was higher than the standard of care in Birmingham, Alabama. And as a result, a doctor in Birmingham could not be guilty of malpractice unless there was a doctor in Birmingham that said he had deviated from the standard. You couldn't bring in some big fancy guy from New York who was in a rich teaching hospital. Now, what has happened in American law is that as there's greater instant communication, information sharing, so there is a concept now that even a rural hospital is capable of having the access to the information of the big urban hospitals. So what was called the locality rule has been abolished. Locality rule used to be of great benefit to physicians because I'm not going to get a Birmingham doctor to testify against me in Birmingham. You have 20 doctors or whatever it is. But now you can bring in the New York person and that's going to be okay. Okay. So what does halacha say? So what is fascinating about halacha is the following. Halacha actually comes out exactly the same as secular law, but they do so by starting with a different premise. Meaning, secular law starts off with fault-based liability generally, and it moves to fault-based liability for physicians. So essentially, it's the same. Halacha starts off with strict liability generally, but it creates a physician immunity that physicians are only liable for negligence or carelessness. So bottom line is, physicians are liable only for negligence. But unlike secular law, which is not creating an exception to the system, but it's simply following the system, Jewish law actually creates a physician exception. Meaning, we apply less of a liability to a physician than we apply to a guy driving a car. If I drive a car and I go through a stop sign because of unavoidable brake failure, I am still responsible, at least, for loss of earnings, medical expenses. If a doctor did something without any negligence that caused damage to the patient, the doctor is not liable at all. There is a physician immunity for non-negligent behavior. Now the question you might ask is, why? Why should I treat a physician any better than I would treat a guy driving a car, including the physician driving the car? So what is fascinating is that a problem that has been identified in current society was pointed out by the commentators to the Talmud 1,000 years ago. And they point out, if physicians would be responsible for negative results, even if they were doing the best job they could, they would be deterred and discouraged from the practice of medicine. And therefore, it is necessary for halacha to absolve physicians of responsibility for untoward results unless there was a carelessness or negligence in their practice. So the point I want to bring out is, The bottom line is, halachic malpractice is actually the same standard as secular malpractice. But as opposed to applying the same rules that you apply to everybody else, halacha starts with a stricter system, and it gives the physician a break in order not to discourage the practice of medicine. Now, according to some commentators, the break is actually much, much greater than even that, and it would be different than secular in the following way. Halacha differentiates in two types of liabilities. Some liabilities are called yidei adam. A human court can make you pay, meaning a court can force you to pay. Other are just called liabilities that are owed to God. They are heavenly liabilities, but they're not legally enforceable. Now, in this day and age, I will admit to you, the distinction almost makes no difference, because even if something in halacha is described as you're obligated by a court to pay, but if you don't go to a Jewish court, you know, they're not going to make you pay. So in a sense, all religious obligations are just religious and spiritual. But when you had a functioning rabbinic court that could force you to pay, certain obligations they could force you to pay, certain obligations they could only tell you you have a duty to pay, but it's not legally, it's not halachically enforceable. According to the Meiri, even if the physician is negligent, he is only spiritually liable. He is not legally, enforceably liable. Now, spiritual liable means God expects you to pay. So, it's important. God does expect you to pay, and God will punish you for not paying, but a court would not make you pay. Okay? So, everyone understand the basic parameters here. Other commentaries say no. Once there's negligence, a Beit Din can order you to pay and could take your property, etc. So that's a machlokas, that's an argument within that concept. Now, therefore, if you look at, you know, what is included in malpractice, you see a number of different types of components. It's a very complicated thing. First and foremost, where all systems say no doctor is ever going to be liable, is simply called a bad outcome. A patient gets cancer, you treat the cancer, the patient dies of the cancer. You know, you're not responsible because you didn't cure them. Meaning, if the only thing that happened was a bad outcome, and there's nothing you could have done better, then that quite literally is an act of God, and under every legal system, American and halacha, nobody is liable for bad outcomes. Now, curiously enough, and no doctor would do this, but we have some court cases going back to the 19th century, there is one situation where a doctor might be liable for a bad outcome. And that is, if the doctor made a contract where he guaranteed a certain result. Now today, nobody does that. The lawyers have drafted all contracts. This is never done. But in the olden days, plastic surgery sometimes went that way, where some physician was foolish enough to guarantee that your nose will look like this or your face will look like this. And if it doesn't, even if the doctor did everything humanly possible, the highest level of skill, the doctor is liable because he broke a contract. But that's going to be, you're not going to see that in your lifetime. No doctor makes a contract promising a specific result. And in fact, there'll be paragraph after paragraph drafted by lawyers saying, we are not promising specific results. And any pictures we show you of, you know, beautiful people after plastic surgery are just samples or whatever it is, or possible outcomes. Okay, all right. So other than that anomaly of the promise, which never happens today, bad outcomes clearly are not within liability. Okay. Now, the opposite situation we would call egregious errors in technique. Here I mean things like giving the patient the wrong medicine. Now, I don't mean wrong medicine because you made a judgment to give this medicine and that's an error in judgment. I'll get to that. I'm talking about patients, you know, got hydrochloric acid in the intravenous line instead of water. Now, these mistakes can theoretically happen. Or the surgeon removed the wrong lung. It does happen. Right, these are not judgment mistakes. These are not evaluative mistakes. These are just mistakes. And these are called gross negligence. In some cases, both halacha and secular would say the physician is liable. The only question you could raise is it so negligent that the physician would be liable for all five things or only for the non-intentional? Okay? So those are the two extremes. Bad outcomes, absolutely no liability. Egregious errors, absolutely liability. But then we have things in the middle. We have what are called judgmental errors. And even that can be subdivided into two. That is, judgmental errors are when you look at a situation and there are different ways of treating it. If you follow treatment modality number one, there are these side effects, A, B, C, D, but there's a potential benefit. If you follow modality number two, there are side effects E, F, G, etc. And you choose one. And you know, of course the patient has to consent, so in a sense, patient consented, but you choose one, but it turns out that that's the wrong one. But even then, that's called a judgment error, meaning you didn't give him the wrong medicine. You made a decision, and that decision was carried out, but it turns out the decision was wrong. But let me point out, even in that category, there are two ways a decision might be proven wrong. Sometimes it's wrong because there was an error in your thinking, and sometimes it's wrong only in hindsight, meaning to say, your thinking was correct, you properly assessed the risks, but nebuch, you know, the downside risk happened. You see, there are two types of, in fact, maybe linguistically, perhaps you shouldn't even call that an error. One can have an interesting semantic question. If you make a decision, in fact, it's not just medicine, in life, you make a decision that turns out wrong, but you properly evaluated all of the data that you had, is that a wrong decision? Is it an erroneous decision? Is it a wrong decision that's not erroneous? This is very tricky. Meaning, that goes back to the saying, hindsight is always 20/20. But the fact that a decision turned out not to work out does not mean it was wrong and erroneous. So, errors of judgment can take two forms. The decision was right when it was made, but it turned out bad. Or, the decision was wrong because I undervalued or overvalued certain components and data. Halacha would make a difference in those two cases. If the decision was wrong because you undervalued data that a more competent person would have seen differently, you may have turned into negligence. If, on the other hand, it is only wrong in the hindsight of the decision, then that's similar to a bad outcome. Okay, so we would make that difference. Then I should mention another type of error, where everything you did was right based on your diagnosis. You followed your diagnosis 100%, but you had the wrong diagnosis, which can be a very, very serious problem. You were treating a non-existent condition, and you weren't treating the right one. Once again, here I would say, both halacha and secular law would work with the same standard. Was there carelessness? Did you fail to live up to the standard? Did you utilize the diagnostic tests that are standard protocol? Once again, if you followed the rules of accepted medical procedure and you had no reason to question your judgment, you will not be liable. Now again, in halacha, but notice the difference. In secular law, that's an application of the general system. In halacha, it's a derivative of the physician exemption. That's fine. But the bottom line is going to be the same. Finally, though, let me mention that there can be negligence, even if you're doing everything the best of your ability. There's negligence of not knowing your limitations. There is actually a concept of being negligent in not referring the patient to somebody more qualified. Now that's a difficult decision for a doctor to make, because obviously, unless you're the best person in the world, there's always somebody more qualified. And that doesn't mean I turn away patients by saying, hey, go to the guy down the street, he's better than me. Nobody's going to tell you you have to do that. But at a point at which you have an awareness of your limitations in a certain area, you have a halakhic duty to refer the person, either to refer or to consult, you know, that could take different forms, with somebody else. Do you remember, I think I mentioned to you that the teaching in the Talmud, the best of the doctors go to hell? According to one interpretation, it's exactly picking up this scenario, that if because of their arrogance, they think they're so great, they don't want to consult with somebody else, they will go to hell. But not only will they go to hell, but they'll get a hit in their pocketbook. There will be halachic malpractice liability. Okay? Now, let me just mention a final point, that because of the malpractice crisis in the United States, there have been a lot of proposals to change the system. And the proposals have taken two forms. In some states, they're combined. In some states, they're separate. Step number one, in some states, not in most states, is they have abolished what are called non-pecuniary awards, meaning awards that are non-economic. They have basically said juries can no longer give either juries can no longer give pain and suffering awards, or there will be a cap on a pain and suffering award not to exceed $250,000. So they have placed limits on pain and suffering compensation for malpractice victims. Interestingly enough, that is a step that I think the halakhic system would support, because you'll recall halakhic compensation for pain and suffering is only when there's intention. In most malpractice, you're not dealing with intention, you're only dealing with carelessness. And in a halakhic system, there would not be compensation for pain and suffering in cases of carelessness. So as a result, a secular reform in that direction would actually bring it closer to a halakhic system. That's one point I want to make. A second movement in some states is that they have tried to replace the idea that the physician or the hospital can be socked for millions and millions of dollars through their insurance company and make it either a publicly funded program where the state has a fund in which it will compensate malpractice victims, or even a physician fund in which every doctor in the state will contribute $200 a month or whatever it would be to create a fund. So instead of each doctor, you know, instead of one doctor paying, you know, $10 million when the accident happens, it would be spread as a fund across a larger number of people. And the theory would be that that would be cheaper than the raise in malpractice premiums that comes out when a single insurance company is hit with this. Now there, I would say the following. We know that halakha very much believes in tzedakah, and the notion that even victims who don't get compensated because of technicalities in halakha are still, if they're poor, they're needy, if they're suffering, if they need economic support, there is a commandment on the community to provide that support. So please understand this. If halakha says a doctor doesn't have to pay for certain things, let's say a doctor doesn't have to pay for bad outcomes, well, that's fine, but what about the person who's paralyzed? So just because the doctor doesn't have to pay doesn't mean the community abandons the person in need. So in a sense, public funding of these systems, I think, is an act of communal tzedakah that halacha would support. And it really avoids a lot of waste in the system, because instead of having to prove that somebody is careless and negligent and expert testimony and run up lawyer's bills, we simply say, if you're hurt, we will have a system to protect you and cover you and give you what you need without having to adjudicate if somebody's at fault. This, by the way, is the system in the United States for workplace injuries. I don't know if you're familiar with this. If you're working in a factory and you get injured by a piece of machinery, instead of having to prove that the company was negligent, which was the old way of doing it, there's something called workman's compensation. You're injured, you get paid. And every employer in a state pays a certain amount of money to create this fund. Now, what this does is, on one hand, it protects victims without them having to show negligence or carelessness. And on the other hand, it prevents catastrophic liability on a business that could wipe it out. So some have suggested, let us apply the workman's compensation model to the medical malpractice area. I think halacha would support that, because halacha would subsume it into communal tzedakah for people that are in need. Of course, the problem with workman's compensation is the amount of money that victims get is relatively small. So that would have to be something to be considered to make the awards more. Of course, that would also raise the taxes on people. But once again, society has to take care of those who cannot take care of themselves. Alrighty, well, thank you, and I guess we'll see you tomorrow again. Bye-bye.